Broadly, what we're going to talk about is a certificate model for HTTPS. I've aimed this talk, if you're an expert in SSL, you're probably not going to learn anything, but I hope you can contribute through the discussion. If you've sort of followed the developments tangentially, then hopefully this talk will be good for you. So HTTPS, of course, is HTTP over SSL. Basically, what it does is it sets up a secure tunnel between you and, say, a web server. And the most important part of the secure tunnel is probably where it ends. So you want some guarantee that this tunnel is ending at the intended party that you're trying to reach. It doesn't end before it leaves your computer or at your router or at your ISP, or it doesn't end at some other entity on the web. And so typically the way we do this is through certificates, which are issued by CAs. And essentially the reason that this is a hot topic now, even though SSL is 15 years old, is that the argument that I would make is that just because you have a certificate that was issued by CA, it's trusted by the browser, that's probably no longer a high enough standard for you to actually trust that you're talking to the end entity. And we've seen examples of this. So the general reasons for this is there's an increase in the number of CAs. We know about breaches of CAs. There's a decrease in how the CAs validate that you actually own a server. And there's a lack of revocation as well. And then on top of all this, everything that's going on in the CA world, you have a bunch of attacks on the TLS protocol itself. And so that doesn't really contribute to the CA problems, but I think it does contribute to the general topic, which is eroding trust in the CA model. Okay, so this is how I think this morning can go. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk for maybe 10, 15 minutes, and I have kind of break points where I'd like to encourage discussion. And I'm going to try and give a primer and bring everyone up to speed on what's going on. Then there's a bunch of solutions that have been proposed. I tried to grab them all here. I may have missed something obvious, hopefully not. But the really nice thing about this is that I know there's people in this room who have worked on one or more of these. And so what would be really great is when we get to this section of the talk, if you'd be willing to get up, and I know you don't have slides. I know I didn't give you any forewarning except for now, and maybe talk for 2 minutes. Just give a pitch for you know, what the problem is you're trying to solve, how you solve it. That would be really great. And then what I'll do is I'll sort of take back control, and any solutions that aren't covered that I think are major solutions, I'll try and sweep those up. And then we'll move into more of a general discussion where you can talk about what you like or dislike about any of these solutions or any really anything you want. That said, just because there's certain parts of this talk where I'm talking, please interject at any time with comments. Okay, so I'm not going to, the main focus of this talk is on the CA, but I feel like I need to do justice to the fact that there have been a number of cryptographic attacks. So I'm not going to try and convince you of how these attacks work, or I'm not trying to explain to them. Mainly what I want to do is I want to show you two things. One, there's a breadth of attacks, and the second thing I want to try and convince you is that this is a recent research area. So these attacks are, these aren't 15-year-old attacks, 10-year-old attacks. These are attacks that have happened or are continuing to happen at a steady rate. So some of the attacks are based on just the fact that some of the primitives TLS uses are sort of aging. There's a paper this week at Usenix Security on attacking RC4 as implemented in TLS. There's some various implementation flaws. Bad randomness is a problem in a lot of systems. Last year at Usenix Security, there was one paper that looked at how RSA keys are generated on embedded devices and showed that because of bad randomness, you can basically recover the private key. Yesterday, there was an attack on truncation attacks at Woot. So these are protocol level flaws. They're not really to do with the crypto, but basically what it allows you to do is you have an SSL traffic flow and the adversary can chop off anything they want from the end of that flow. Earlier, there was a problem with the renegotiation part of the protocol, which allowed an adversary to prepend chosen data to the start of a traffic flow. So they're kind of the opposites. Downgrade attacks is something I'm going to come back to in about 2 slides. There's other ones that attack, for example, the fact that if you grab a ciphertext, a traffic flow going to a server, you modify it, the server's happy to decrypt it. And so, for example, at Oakland, there was a paper, this extends a whole line of research, but they looked at the fact that you could distinguish, basically, the decryption's going to fail if you modify it because there's a MAC in it. But it may fail earlier than checking the MAC because the padding is wrong. And so if you can manipulate it correctly, You can, and if you can distinguish between whether it's a padding error or a MAC error, then you can start to extract information. You can actually recover secrets out of it. So that was the Lucky 13 attack. There was an attack called Beast, and this is based on the fact that if, for example, if I'm a malicious website and I'm running JavaScript on a person's computer, I can request, make HTTPS requests. So what that will do is it'll take the plain text that I supply, it will encrypt it, and then if I can observe the ciphertext, I can grab it. And so it's sort of like a chosen plain text oracle. Now you might say, well, what's the attack there? Because if I'm choosing the plain text, who cares if I can, you know, if I can decrypt it? But what happens is that often in a lot of web apps, secrets will be prepended to the data, for example, cookies. And so I'll choose part of the plain text, there'll be a secret portion of the plain text, and I'm going to try and use what I chose in order to recover the secret part of the plain text. So that's the basic attack. So there's the Beast, and it's based on just the fact that CBC mode should be CPA secure, but the way that IVs are set up in TLS 1.0, it's not secure. And then this year, last year there was an attack called Crime, and then there's a more general one at Black Hat called Breach, which are basically looking at how compression's used, and it's the same principle. Okay, so the first thing I would note is what I found interesting about the RC4 attack is, first off, it makes RC4 insecure. It doesn't matter what version of TLS you're using, okay? The CBC attacks, your only alternative to using RC4 is CBC modes if you're using TLS 1.0. 99% of the servers use TLS 1.0. TLS 1.0 came out in, I was going to write in the dates, but it was in the 90s, I think. And then the latest version, which I think came out in the mid-2000s, is 1.2. And we're only at a 0.02% adoption rate of this newest standard. Now it fixes, actually 1.1 and 1.2 fix the CBC issue, and it also gives you access to authenticated modes of operation. Okay, so what's really good is if everyone can move to here, then we don't have to choose between two insecure cipher modes. Now, there's two things I'll say. One is you can do patchwork solutions. So there, for example, there's these record splitting techniques that you can do to resolve these issues and stay at 1.0. But the other problem, and the reason I listed this under downgrades, is that when you do the handshake or the negotiation, it doesn't actually protect the fact that the server and the client want to talk 1.2. So if both the server and client are happy to talk 1.2, and there's an adversary who's in the middle, and usually they're in the middle to exploit any of these attacks anyway, they can downgrade, they can force a downgrade to 1.0. So the first discussion point, or the first opportunity I want to open up to discussion is, I'm really interested in, you know, why haven't servers updated? What's wrong with the incentive models that prevent servers from updating to 1.0 to 1.2? Is it a big deal? I mean, it seems pretty bad. It seems like we should try and encourage updates. Maybe it's okay, maybe the patchwork solutions at 1.0 are fine. And is there anything that we can do to change the incentive model to encourage? Because once everyone updates to 1.2, maybe we want to push people to 1.3, 1.4 when they come out. Is there something we can do differently that time around in order to encourage updates? I don't know if anyone has a comment on that. Okay, I'll move on. Okay, so now we'll talk a bit about the CA model. So for this part of the discussion and onward, we're just going to assume that the crypto works flawlessly. Okay, so set aside all the crypto attacks, and let's just pretend that the crypto works perfectly. And really, the only prerequisite for the crypto to work is you have to get the correct public key of the domain if you're the client. So you're connecting to a domain. If you can just get their correct public key, then the crypto will take care of everything else in terms of setting up the secure client. So this sounds like a pretty easy problem, right? How do you just get the key of the domain? And yet the fact that, you know, the rest of this talk is going to be about just this one problem should be an indication that it's not as easy as it seems. So the way that we traditionally do it is the key is bound to the domain by some certificate authority that signs off. It says this key belongs to this domain. Of course, there's a lot more in the certificate than just that I'm simplifying. Now, we haven't really solved the problem. All we've done is sort of pushed it. So now instead of the domain trying to, or the client trying to figure out if he's talking to domain.ca, the CA, before they issue the certificate, they've got to try and figure out if they're talking to the real domain. So what are these certificate authorities? So there's a set of root certificates that are preloaded into either your browser or your operating system. There's about 150 of them, and they come from about 50 organizations. But these aren't all the certificate authorities. Root certificates can authorize, or they can delegate, the ability to issue certificates to other parties or entities. And these are called intermediate CAs. You don't see an intermediate CA until you see a certificate that's been issued by one, and you trace it back to the root. So there's no way to just look up all the intermediates, unless if you crawl the web, which some projects have done, like the SSL Observatory. And if you run the numbers, they're fuzzy for a whole variety of reasons. But there was a paper at Weiss this year that had a good estimate of, I'd say, about 200 organizations that have some sort of intermediate CA. Now, the reason that this is a problem is that basically any CA can issue an acceptable certificate for any site, or at least in the base case of TLS, this is the case. And so the idea is, if you're going to attack a CA or if you're going to try and trick a CA, you can pick from, you have your pick of 200 organizations. Now, one question we might ask is, first off, the model that we're trying to achieve is, I get a new computer, I turn it on for the first time, and automatically it trusts, 1 million sites. And that's something that, there's no real world, and there's nothing analogous in the real world to that. In the real world, we wouldn't think that, you could be born and not talk to anyone, and then all of a sudden, have trust relationships with 1 million people. So maybe what we're trying to do is, maybe we're trying to bite off more than we can chew. Another thing that's been suggested is maybe we should do some sort of name constraint. So CAs can only issue for a Canadian CA could only issue for .ca, for example. The big problem with name constraints is that, who gets to control .com, right? Everyone wants to control that. So first off, is there any comments on this? Is this reasonable problem that we're trying to solve? Should trust be more, should it try and model the real world a bit more, where it's based on, I trust people in the room because I trust someone who knows these people? Yeah, Nikita? So there's sort of it's kind of like two problems. There's the, I want to go to see like a bank. I was going to name a Canadian bank, which no one in this room's heard of. But I want to go to a bank, Bank of America, and what's their URL? So that's one problem. That's sort of the cognitive gap problem. And then there's the problem of, okay, I know it's bankofamerica.com, or I know this is their address. What's their public key? And so you're saying that the CA infrastructure just provides that one piece of it. Okay, and then I think CAs were probably originally envisioned to bind more than just those two informations, but certainly we'll talk in a few slides that that's what has become. Yeah?
I mean, one other thing that I've been thinking about a little bit is the fact that, I mean, what's the real problem? Is it for the users or for the businesses, right? I mean, the CAs are really there to kind of say, you can trust this business or this bank, and so on. And, the users don't have the resources to really say, okay, yeah, I know I can trust them. But the banks do. And the banks have a lot more to lose. And so you could say, I'm not going to worry about it. It's all good. Because, if the banks start seeing a lot of withdrawals illegally, then they're going to say, okay, well, we need to put in, a couple of days' revenue, $5 or $6 billion in fixing this problem, versus the other side, which is, it's kind of hard for the regular users to really even approach the problem.
So that kind of ties back to Joe's talk too, where, you know, passwords is sort of the same problem. If you recover a bank password, what can you really do? And so Cormac Hurley's talked a bit about this. If all transactions are reversible and they're traceable, you know, same thing if you can intercept people's passwords because you have a fraudulent certificate for a bank, it may not actually net you any money in the end. Yeah.
So, I mean, we're putting a lot of time and effort into something that is meaningless. I mean, we need a solution, but I think that this solution has already been destroyed.
Right, so there's, I think there's room to revisit when connections fail, what exactly, how do you react to it? And so there's obviously lots of usability studies on how effective warnings are that are displayed to users, and it's pretty dismal, right? Users don't really understand the warnings. Maybe, you know, you don't want to hard fail all the time because you're going to lose users. And so, yeah, there is definitely a trade-off there. And I think there's room and maybe research opportunity to try and investigate that further and sort out, you know, when hard fail should be used, when warnings should be used, how warnings should be worded, and if we can sort of retrain users to pay attention to warnings when they just click. Yeah, what security advice? Anyways, so some of the solutions that we'll look at would actually enable self-signed certificates to become sort of valid in the browser scheme, but we'll talk about that much later in the talk. Okay, so anyways, let's go back to CAs, and now I want to talk a bit about how they do this validation process. And so the way it was originally envisioned was this would be a human validation process, so you'd show up with some business documents, you might talk on the phone, you might do it in person. But for economic reasons mainly, it's now become an automated system, at least for the easiest way to get certificates. Okay. In some kind of infinite loop. Sorry about that. Let's see if I can pull it up. If anyone has a comment while I struggle with this. Great. Or if anyone sees my notes. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so I got this back. So the main way, or one common way of doing it, is if you want to prove to a CA that you own domain.ca, they're going to send you a validation link or a token or something to an email address like admin@domain.ca. And so I thought it would be interesting. I actually just read a blog post this morning about this. Let's unpack what exactly is going on here and what the trust assumptions are. I mean, it's a very simple technique, right? But really what's going on is, okay, so we'll start here. So you have the CA, and before they send the email, of course, they have to find the DNS name for the IP address for the mail server. So they consult with DNS, and that's put into the DNS system by some registrar, and there's somebody who has a password to the registrar that hopefully is affiliated with domain.ca. Okay, so that's great. Then we have the email, we send the email, so it goes to the mail server. That's run by someone else, maybe the same person, maybe someone different, that's affiliated with domain.ca. And then the mail gets routed to someone's inbox, and once again, there's somebody who has the password to that email. So let's think about the trust assumptions here. So first off, this is password dependent, right? For both this step and for this step, you have people logging in with passwords. If you can crack the password, you can basically get a fraudulent certificate. You have to trust your registrar. If the registrar is untrustworthy or if it's compromised, then there may be ways of getting a fake certificate. You have to trust that the CA has a good vision of the DNS system. So if you can pick your favorite DNS attack and somehow corrupt the CA's view of the DNS system, this typically isn't done over DNSSEC, just vanilla DNS, then you can also get a fraudulent certificate. The CA composes an email. Email between mail servers often isn't even encrypted at all. A lot of time it's sent in the plain text. Other times it's sent with self-signed certificates. There's often not an encrypted channel there. Okay, so this is kind of like the NSA channel. They can grab it there. So it hits the mail server, and then of course you have to be careful about what domains you're giving out and who you're giving them out to. Right, so everyone knows that you shouldn't give a min at your domain out to, you know, just anyone, or if you're Hotmail, that you shouldn't let people register it. The problem is that every CA has a slightly different list of what these domains are, and some of the handles get sort of esoteric. For example, someone registered SSL certificates at hotmail.com, and they were able to get a CA to give them a certificate for login.microsoft.com.
The magic names should all be uniform.
Sorry, can you say that again?
The magic names, the magic email addresses, yeah, should all be uniform across all CAs, so this is the baseline.
Okay, so, and who, or where is that declared, or mandated?
Sorry?
Where is that mandated?
By the CAP form.
By the CAP form? Okay, that's great. Okay, so what are some of the problems with CAs beyond just that validation? So that's all the stuff, all the trust that you have to put in besides the CA itself. You also have to obviously trust the CA itself. And so first off, we have to make sure that CAs are issuing the proper certificate. So domains should get what's called a site certificate. They shouldn't be authorized to become a CA themselves. There was a problem with a CA recently called Turk Trust where they issued a CA certificate instead of a site certificate. It's obvious maybe as well, but it's worth repeating, the browser should check that, you know, it's supplying a site certificate and not a CA certificate, and not, that wasn't always the case. The main worry is that the CA process, the issuing process, isn't circumvented. And so probably the main driver of research in this area recently is the case of DigiNotar and Komodo, which are two CAs that had their validation, or their issuing process violated, and people were able to obtain certificates, fraudulent certificates that they shouldn't have been able to, and in some cases actually conducted man-in-the-middle attacks in the wild with these certificates. Even if you have human verification, you still can make mistakes. So for example, VeriSign issued an ex-Microsoft employee a certificate for Microsoft. This was for code signing, not for SSL, but I thought it was close enough, so I threw it in. The other thing we worry about is that CAs, you know, I said there's about 200 organizations, they're in countries all over the world. Some of these countries have arguably oppressive governments, and so there is also worry that maybe a government might try and compel a certificate using legal means and maybe using hidden laws or secret laws in order to get a certificate. And so there was a recent case of, there was a CA that was in the UAE, I believe, that Mozilla was discussing kicking out of the root store because they had done some other stuff on the code signing side. I don't know if anyone knows if they actually got kicked out or not. Okay, and are they still in the Mozilla root store, or did they get kicked out?
I haven't heard that they kicked out, and weren't they intermediate from someone anyway?
Yeah, right. Maybe it was the root CA that signed it. I forget the details. But anyway, there was a very active discussion on the Mozilla forums. Yeah, see.
I downloaded the root CA that's trusted by most of the major browsers. It was Microsoft. 10% of them were overtly
not from Microsoft.
Anyways, I wanted to save some, a little time for discussion of the solution. So I'm just going to quickly, I just have two more slides on stuff. Revocation is kind of a mess. It's getting better now. What browsers are doing is they're pulling the revocation lists into the browsers themselves, so you don't have to worry about it. Traditionally, you would have to ping the CA every time that you formed a connection, and the CAs often wouldn't respond, or an adversary could just drop that ping. Other attacks, if you don't even have a certificate, what you could do is you could just, if someone, just try and keep your users on HTTP. If they try and move over to HTTPS, you just downgrade them back to the HTTP and hope that they don't notice that there's a lock missing when there should be a lock. The other thing you could do is just use a certificate that's not valid and hope that people click through the warning. So this goes back to the comment earlier. So there was a case of Syria Telecom, at least a CA in the name of that organization, doing a man-in-the-middle attack on Facebook. So the security or the usability literature seems to suggest that users tend to ignore security indicators. Most of them don't understand it. And even if they do understand it, they're often will click through warnings, even if they do understand it. OK, what to do? So this is where I'm really relying on maybe getting some discussion going. Yeah, go ahead.
I would disagree with that bottom statement about users ignoring security indicators. I think
that
it's really commonly held belief, but I don't think that's true for modern. That is true for the current SSL warning, but not true for other security indicators in the browser.
OK, so this, I'll just qualify this. This was based on some, there's a few papers. I should say that this whole talk is based on a survey paper we put at Oakland this year. And if you're interested in anything I've said, please consult that. And it has all the citations in it. This was based on usability research. There was a study.
I work at Google. I do metrics.
You have a, do you have a paper at USIX Security as well?
Yeah, and that's not true for all security.
Yeah, so what did you find anything about SSL warnings? Can you give?
People do click through them a lot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
But I'm just saying it's not hopeless. It's just that that warning in particular isn't particularly good.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's great. And yeah, these comments are definitely limited to the SSL role. Okay, I know there's people in the room who have worked on these things. I was wondering if any of them would volunteer to maybe give a pitch for any of these solutions. If not, I'm going to start calling out names. I'm just going to give you a mic. So Ben Laurie, Google,
talking about CT.
And then Adam, you can talk, and I know Joe has done
some
work too.
So CT, the idea is that you have logs of all certificates. The logs are, they can cryptographically prove their own correct operation, and certificates contain an assurance from a log, or more than one log maybe, that they are in one of the logs, and browsers should not accept certificates unless they see that assurance. And then the other piece of the puzzle is everyone who cares about certificates, i.e. owners of sites or just CAs or just interested parties, can watch the logs and see any misissues and then take appropriate action. So that's the really short version. The long version is really, really long. So that's it.
Good. Anyone else? Maybe Adam, can you talk about some of the browser preloads? I don't want to put you on the spot. But
so which browser preloads?
In Chrome. So what you do for pinning, for example.
Oh.
Or HSTS.
So we have this horrible, very high maintenance, very dangerous solution called pinning, which is implemented in Chrome by simply saying, for these websites, the certificate chain must include this public key, and if it doesn't, reject it without any possibility of override. This did catch DigiNotar in 2011, I guess. It also gives me more or less a stress ulcer every time we change our certificates, because if we ever screw up, we are really, really badly screwed, right? Because Chrome will simply stop working when it contacts Google. So it is not a scalable solution. It is a fairly high security solution. It has worked, but I would not advocate it for the general population. If the general population do wish to shoot themselves in the foot, Chrome now supports pinning via HTTP headers. The same way as HSGS, you can now advertise a pin for your site and shoot yourself in the foot and take it down.
OK, great. Joe, do you want to talk about S-Links quickly?
You know, for example, with pinning, if you don't preload your pin in the browser, if you're setting it through a header, then you have this trust on first use problem with the pin. So the idea is that you could specify a policy like pinning in links on the web. So if you get to the site for the first time from somebody you already trust, they can give you a pin to just use on the first connection. And then if that checks out, then you can pick up a long-term pin once you get there. Tried to think about the problem generally and just say, if different sites have different security policies, if they require any kind of extra checking, you can either preload that all in the browser, but that doesn't scale, so finding it through the person that introduced you to the site is one place to put the information. I mean, there's you know, a lot of open questions about how to get the UI right, and will this make introduce more dead links on the web, stuff like that. But the advantage is that it's no latency. You don't have to do any extra queries. You can put it in band, and maybe the trust model is closer to what users already understand. Because if you're clicking on a link on the web, you know, you're sort of already trusting wherever that link came from to get you to the right address. So security information could go there too. So securelinks.org. There's kind of a proto spec up.
Okay. Anyone else?
And I could just say something about URLs, YURLs. Yep. This came from Tyler Close's work on WaterCan about 10 years ago. That's where I learned it from. Most of these techniques are about maintaining the binding from an existing domain name to some certificate. S-Links push that up into the URL so that whoever gives you that href tells you which site they really meant, which certificate they really meant. URLs are about pushing it up into the domain name. So the idea would be that your domain name is now sha256.hexhexhex.something.something. And the lookup function says if the certificate has a public key with that hash in it, then that's good, otherwise it's not. So it's more user visible in that sense. It's a little bit uglier, but it lets you push that link all the way up into whoever gave you the domain name, not just the link.
Great. Any other takers? Yeah, Joe, Jose?
It's a question that sometimes may be a solution. Has any of you looked at of the 40-odd root certificates that are in the browser, in your everyday life, how many of them get actually used? Is it 4, 5, 2, 10, half?
So I think there's a pretty long-tail distribution. So the most, I've heard the statistics, I can't repeat them off the top of my head, but there's a small number of CAs that account for a large number of certificates.
I mean, it would seem to suggest that for a user-based low-tech solution, you just delete or deactivate the ones that are not going to get used, and it's a bit like the NoScript version of certificates, right?
Yeah.
I only activate the ones that I know are going to be useful. I don't know.
Right, so you can turn off, you could do like a NoScript like a firewall approach where you kind of turn everything off and then turn them on as you need them. But if you make an intelligent decision about not turning something on, it's... Okay, I'll sweep up a few more. We just have a couple minutes left. So another way this was alluded to, if you're a server, you can say, I only use these four CAs. You can send that down every time you send down HTTP in a header, or you can put it in your handshake. We talked about preloads. Another interesting proposal that I think at least deserves a minute or two is we could put actual keys, or maybe if we generalize the idea a bit more, we could put pins into DNS. And then when you fetch the domain or the IP address for the domain name, you could also get the pin or the certificate at the same time. This is good. It's very scalable. The big problem is that at least there's an understanding that DNSSEC is required in order to do this. And there's a nice paper coming up at USIX as well on maybe some of the scalability issues with DNSSEC. What's nice about this solution, though, is it has the potential to actually cut CAs out, at least for domain validated certificates, out completely. So people could put their self-issued certificates into their DNS records, and then your browser could trust it. So that may be a weakness of the model. Sorry?
It doesn't work. You can't do the lookups.
Because what?
You can't do the lookup. DNS is filtered to such an extent that this requires a hard fail. If you don't get the records and you don't let it go through, well, that locks out something like 5 to 10% of all users.
Right, right, right. Yeah, so I think that's going to be touched on at the UseX paper as well. Yeah. The other thing you could do is ask friends, you know, what certificates do you see? So there's projects like Perspectives and Convergence that are along this line. We talked about certificate transparency. Just a tease, in the Oakland paper, we do a very systematic evaluation of a whole bunch of different primitives. We have a bunch of properties. And I was going to talk about this, but I'm going to skip it for time. And so maybe we have time for one or two? One question. Anyways, thank you very much.